program that you are about to hear is brought to you for a blind and a print-impaired audience from the North Carolina Reading Service. And it is the Indie Week, and it's read by John Federson today. The issue is dated October the 12th of 2023. So sit back or lean forward and relax. It's completely up to you, and we'll get started with this week's issue. First article about the recent primary elections. Leonardo Williams and Mike Woodard are set to square off next month to become Durham's next mayor. Williams was able to balance campaigning with his responsibilities on council and build a strong coalition of voters. He led primary results, receiving 51.28% of total ballots cast. Woodard came in second with 29.04%. Sitting council member Didriana Freeman was the next closest with 14.10%. Only the top two mayoral candidates move on to the general election. Freeman will remain in her current council seat till 2025. If Williams wins the mayoral race, the incoming council will have to vote on candidates to fill his Ward 3 vacancy. He will remain on council until 2025 if Woodard wins. Woodard, who's currently serving as a state senator, can also return to his seat if he's not elected mayor. In addition to the two mayoral candidates, Durham will elect three of the six remaining at-large council candidates in November. And the six remaining, Nate Baker, Javier Caballero, Carl Rist, Khalila Karim, Sheila Ann Huggins, and Monique Hosey Hyman. With endorsements from the Triangle, DSA, and the committee, Baker has established a wide-reaching base of supporters. He edged out Caballero by 125 votes as the top vote recipient in the city council primary race at 18.2%. Rist was not far behind them, 17.6%. Both incumbents, Caballero and Holsey Hyman, still have a shot at returning to council, though Holsey Hyman's path seems more uncertain with only 8.19% of the vote. Roughly 11.6% of eligible voters cast a ballot in the primary. This is slightly higher than the percentage of total voters in that primary back in 2021. Durham has never gotten higher than 15% of ballots cast for municipal primary, and voter turnout for the primary tends to be lower than the general election. Durham's 37th precinct in the northwestern part of the city brought in the most votes, 1,575 cast. Only five other precincts total more than 1,000 ballots cast. They covered the southern and westernmost parts of Durham in neighborhoods like Forest Hills and Woodcroft. Early voting for the general election begins pretty soon, October 19th, and Election Day, November the 7th. Learn more about early voting at the Durham County Board of Elections website. I'm going to read entitled Op-Ed by Maya Honda, and it's elective election-related. Where was the outrage from Orange County elected officials when crypto money flooded a congressional race? Two, Orange County elections 1 year apart present a clear picture of what it will take for us to defend our democracy and ensure free and fair elections in North Carolina. This week, Chapel Hill Town Council member Karen Stigman published a blog post entitled, "Is This the End of Fair Elections in Chapel Hill?" She described a group of wealthy donors who have put together a super PAC, Political Action Committee, in order to flood Chapel Hill's local elections with over $100,000 in order to influence the outcome of the race. "Let's be clear, this is not business as usual," she said. "Do we really want to go down this path here in Chapel Hill?" Well, Chapel Hill already went down this path 1 year ago, and not a single Orange County elected official said a word. In fact, over 20 elected officials enthusiastically endorsed. Now, Congresswoman Valerie Fouché, the recipient of almost $4 million of super PAC money from crypto billionaire Sam Bankman-Fried, now, parentheses, likely to go to jail for stealing money from his investors to influence elections, and Republican-funded pro-Israel PACs. Fouché faced almost no accountability from her endorsers regarding her acceptance of the money, which made NC04's congressional primary race one of the most expensive in North Carolina history. I served, writes the editorial writer, as the campaign manager for Durham County Commissioner Nida Alam, whose progressive views caused these super PACs to spend big on behalf of now Congresswoman Fouché. We came away from that election more firmly rooted in our belief that big money has no place in our political system at any level, and we must all be clear and consistent about our values in order to uphold our democracy and fight back against the influence of super PACs in politics. In the primary last year, Chapel Hill elected officials were content to silently reap the benefits of super PAC spending when it was in support of their preferred candidate. But in this year's local municipal races, they're facing enormous oppositional PAC spending, and the outcry has been immediate, as it should be. Hopefully, the combined efforts of local leaders to draw attention to this issue will ensure that the voices of Chapel Hill voters prevail without being unduly influenced by undemocratic dark money. So there's three or four more paragraphs to this, but that's the essence of this op-ed by Maya Handa, who's calling this crypto money, and I guess that's from Sam Bankman-Fried, but there's other donors to these funds as well. I will excerpt a couple of these later next articles. They're education-related, one about the Durham School Board, and another brief announcement from Wake County. Former superintendent is appointed to North Carolina Board of Education, Governor Cooper appointed former Wake County Superintendent Kathy Moore to an at-large seat on the state board. She's a veteran educator who spent more than 35 years in the Wake County public school system, the last five as superintendent. She fills the seat James Ford vacated last month. Cooper noted Moore's many awards in the announcement. She's former Wake County Principal of the Year, North Carolina Central Region Principal of the Year, the PTA Superintendent of the Year, and the Magnet Schools of America National Superintendent of the Year. She retired as superintendent of the state's largest school district in July. She told the News and Observer she's planned to spend more time with family, but was open taking on something super flexible and something that I'm really passionate about. And then from Durham, the Durham School Board has ordered a plan to address racial achievement gaps. The academic performance improved over the last school year, but achievement gaps between the district's black and Hispanic students and other students remain stark. In a September 28th meeting, the school board instructed the superintendent to develop a plan to shrink these disparities. In a unanimous vote, they directed Paul Pascal Mubenga to return with an achievement plan by December of this year. And then there are some statistics. According to a report presented to the board, over 88% of DPS schools met or exceeded academic goals in 22 and 23. And all demographic subgroups saw improvements between 21-22 and 22-23 school years. The district's black students saw a 4.4% increase, Hispanic a 3.2% increase, white students a 3.5%, and 0.8% for Asian, 4.5% for multiracial, and 1.5% for students with limited English proficiency. But big disparities remain. 22-23 school year statistics compiled by the District Offices of Research and Accountability and Equity Affairs show 39.5% of black students and 37.4% of Hispanics scored at or above proficiency on standardized tests, 39 and 37. White students, 82.7%. Asian students, 63.3% and 56.8% of multiracial students met or exceeded the standards. Students with limited English proficiency had the lowest rates, with 18.4%. Jessica Carter Outen, board member, said many of our students, including black and Hispanic, are doing amazingly, academically and otherwise, but the reality is, once you dig into our data a little bit deeper, is that many of those students are really struggling academically. The resolution builds on the 23 through 28 strategic plan that was approved unanimously back in May. A secondary goal is to address district suspension rates, with the aim of reducing the number of black and Hispanic students suspended to 5% or lower. While data on school suspensions this year has not yet been released, 21-22 school year, Durham Public disproportionately suspended black and Hispanic students. And then it gives statistics about that. Board member Millicent Rogers said, "We invest millions of dollars into proactive solutions to ensure student success, yet so many of our children are still struggling. Let's pay attention to that investment." As always in the Triangle area and environment, the housing issues, fair housing, subsidized housing, housing transportation, and things like that are in the forefront of every elected official's mind, one hopes. And I have a couple of articles I can read to you about that, a little shorter, before we get to some of our feature-length films. Raleigh Council accepts funding for bus rapid transit and approves redevelopment south of Moore Square. Projects years in the making, writes Jasmine Gallup, are finally coming to fruition as the City Council approved funding, site plans, and zoning changes that will transform the city. But some argue the changes will have unintended consequences, including, guess what, displacement and gentrification. After 10 years of planning, construction on the New Bern Avenue bus rapid transit route is finally set to start in December or January. The council approved about $89 million for this project. The BRT, bus rapid transit route on New Bern Avenue. I know that stretch well. That stretches from downtown Raleigh, 5.5 miles, to New Hope Road, outside of I-40-40 Beltway. Also includes stops at Wake Med and East Raleigh neighborhoods. During high traffic times, buses are scheduled to stop every 10 minutes, vastly improving the existing transport system. The city is set to purchase 7 new energy-efficient buses for the route. Once it's complete, likely in the summer of 25, New Bern Avenue will have 3.3 miles of dedicated bus lanes, 10 stations and 19 platforms, along with a multi-use path and sidewalk improvements in place. 5 more routes to the west, north, and south, with connections to Garner, Clayton, and RTP, are in design and planning stages, according to staff. In addition to building this new BRT route, the City Council intends to change zoning rules along New Bern Avenue to encourage denser development. Council members say the Transit Overlay District, the TOD, will incentivize developers to construct affordable housing, commercial spaces that offer job opportunities, and pedestrian-friendly plazas and streets. Some local activists, however, are worried that these zoning changes will hasten gentrification of some of the city's historically African-American neighborhoods. Increased density and building heights may attract developers who want to build upscale apartment buildings and high-end retail that is unaffordable to current residents. Many Raleighites have already been displaced because of similar development in other parts of the city. These activists also worry the zoning rules don't do enough to guarantee affordable housing for the residents who need it most, those making 30% AMI or below. That's the average median income. Members of the Wake County Housing Justice Coalition began protesting the TOD last year, and commenters have continued to show up at Planning Commission committee meetings to raise their concerns over the plans. The Commission's Committee of the Whole has been discussing the proposed zoning changes since April, but the deadline to make recommendations to the Council is rapidly approaching. On Tuesday, the city approved amendments to the TOD in response to public comments, removing a prohibition on 1- and 2-unit housing structures in the area and limiting the size of non-residential constructs like gyms in apartment buildings. The commission must take action soon, by October the 23rd, according to the current schedule. Its members are expected to discuss the matter later this month. I'll bet they are. They also face a decision on whether the city's comprehensive plan, its guidelines for future development, should be amended to address residents' concerns around New Bern Avenue. The deadline for action on that set of amendments, November the 22nd. Well, also on Tuesday, the council approved expansion of the Moore Square site slated for redevelopment. That's right downtown, Moore Square, near the Central Bus Station. Construction is expected to start within the next several months. Affordable housing east of Moore Square will be built first, followed by a hotel near City Market. More than 500 housing units are planned. 160 to 190 are reserved for affordable housing. The units will be available to people making a mix of incomes, broken down as follows. 30 units reserved for residents making 80% of AMI or below. 70 units making 60% of AMI. 30 units for making 50% of AMI. And 24 for those making the lowest AMI, 30%. Activists raised some concerns about the plan to redevelop Moore Square last year when the council first sought proposal from developers. The former city council encouraged developers to include affordable housing but didn't specify how much or at what income levels. Some were worried proposals would not include enough affordable housing or serve Raleigh's most in-need residents. Today, activist Reeves Peeler says he remains concerned. Quote, I think our former city council could have been much bolder and had a better vision of what Raleigh truly needs than this plan they chose. Not only do I think we could have gotten more housing and gotten it both plats, but also I think it's disappointing they chose a plan for Eastmore that segregates the market and low-income housing into separate buildings. On Tuesday, city staff said the developer's proposal was among the best they received, both in terms of number of affordable units and availability to residents, with a mix of income levels. As a part of the project, the developer will build a new headquarters for Raleigh Rescue Mission. That's a nonprofit that ministers to the homeless. The project also includes 2 hotels, retail and dining, a grocery store, and a co-working space. Looking ahead, the Raleigh City Council approved $206 million in funding for its new headquarters on the East Civic Tower. Now, a major article that's very involved, very detailed, and comprehensive on Durham's progress 4 years after voters passed a $95 million affordable housing bond. And this is by Cy Neff, and it's one of the newer extensive articles that IndyWeek has begun producing, and it's way too long, unfortunately, for me to read all. I urge anybody in the Durham area to take a look at this article on IndyWeek.com. It includes some graphic charts, and what it basically does, there are some goals, and it goes down, breaks down goal by goal of what the city has set as a standard for itself, and it tells in every instance how far along that goal the city is going. And I'll read some of the categories from this, and the just the bare bones. And there's all kinds of background on this and detail. That's if you live in Durham, you might want to have a look at. So, it's a lack of affordable housing, writes SINEF, has dominated the public discourse for years. And they overwhelmingly passed in Durham this $95 million affordable housing bond with the goal of upgrading those options. The largest affordable housing bond ever passed in the state at the time. It was coupled with an existing $65 million in local federal funding, ultimately creating the $160 million Forever Home Durham program. The city aims to allocate all funds from this program for spending and in contract by the end of the 2026 fiscal year. Forever Home Durham plays a key role in the Durham Housing Authority's Downtown Durham and Neighborhood Plan, which aims to revitalize the existing downtown property and ensure that Durham's low-income residents benefit from its economic boom. Since Forever Home Durham and DDNP launched, the Durham area has seen a massive increase in property values. The outbreak of a pandemic, an eviction crisis, and a staffing shortage in the city's community development department, which has, according to its director, has seen a vacancy rate of 33% in the department until recent weeks. So, all of the following metrics track the progress since July of 2019 on the bond's stated goals. All budgetary figures were provided directly by the city of Durham and reflect spending as of February of this year. All progress metrics come from a presentation by the Forever Home Durham team. So here I go, and I'm feeling my way along as I go. There's paragraph after paragraph of details, but I'll read in effect these little charts. Multifamily rentals, to construct them. The goal, construct 1,600 affordable rental units. And what's the progress? 162 have been completed, 451 are under contract, and 1,257 are in pipeline, which makes for a total of 1,870 affordable housing units. That's an expected 270 more than the target. And what does these terms mean? The majority are in pipeline. In pipeline means the discussions with contractors and developers are underway and that money is being allocated for a project, but no contract has been executed. Details and finances of projects are still under discussion, and in pipeline projects have the potential to fall through. The newly completed 162 units are made up of 80 new units at the Joyce, an affordable housing complex for age 62 and up, and the Acadia, an 82-unit complex in South Durham. Then there's more details about those, the income limits for these particular projects. The next goal of the bond issue, homelessness support. The goal, move 1,700 unhoused community members from emergency shelter into permanent housing. What's the progress on that? 1,481 unhoused people have been moved from emergency shelters into permanent housing since July of 2019. Durham's diversity of programs and funding designed to assist the city's unhoused, which I guess they're now calling homeless people, We've been able to leverage housing choice vouchers, rapid rehousing projects, and permanent supportive housing, different streams of funding that have come through, said Colin Davis, the homeless system manager for the Durham's Community Development Department. So right now, they have their goal, 1,700. They've achieved, as of today, as of now, close to 1,500. That's a majority of their goals. Davis says, despite these encouraging numbers, homelessness is on the rise, particularly among households with children. Those working in services point to Durham's rising cost of living and affordable housing crisis as major contributing factors. The challenges have gotten harder, Davis says. Homelessness is not the problem. It's a symptom of the larger failures of a variety of systems that create these people experiencing homelessness. So what has been spent on multifamily rental spending. Where did I get that? I'm going to pause for a second. All right. I have missed one of the goals. Preserve multifamily rentals. And the goal is to preserve 800 of these rental units. And according to Forever Home, 355 have been preserved thus far out of 800. 56 are under contract, 17 pipeline units, with 362 units awaiting preservation plans. Then they list what those multifamily rentals include. So back to homelessness. So, oh, and the spending, excuse me, the rental spending on for these particular area of the program, $95 million remains, $11 million has been spent. Then we're back to the homeless services, and it talks about moving people from emergency shelters into permanent housing. And the spending on that is $5 million has been spent and $5 million remaining. So they spent about half of the allocated funds for this feature of their plans. Next, affordable home ownership, and it's called neighborhood stabilization. The goal, create 400 opportunities for low-income home buyers. 400 opportunities is the goal. Progress, 0 opportunities created. 6 under contract, 90 in the pipeline. That comes to 96. Kind of, sort of, you know, on the way of maybe being finished, and 304 yet to go. And there's down payment assistance programs, Habitat for Humanity, and hitting the original 400 opportunities is unlikely without additional funding, largely due to increased housing costs. So far, 75,000 has been spent on down payment assistance, and 6,200,000 is remaining for that goal. That's pretty depressing, I'd say. Housing stability and home repair. The goal there, neighborhood stabilization, it's called. And the goal here is to get 3,000 in low-income renters stabilized in their homes. And right now, they're over halfway to that goal. 1,800 are stabilized, and 1,200 are remaining. Neighborhood stabilization, run by various Durham agencies, including eviction diversion, persons with AIDS-based financial assistance, and substantial rehab and minor repair programs. And the bulk of the number in this category comes from diversions conducted by NC Legal Aid's Durham Eviction Diversion Program. And that's it for that category. Spent on, so far, $2.3 million has been spent. $16 million remains to spend on this, on that category. Next goal, create at least $130 million in contracting opportunities for minority and women-owned businesses. The goal, at least 30% of those dollars being spent on contracting opportunities should be go towards minority and women-owned businesses. 30% is the goal. Thus far, $14 million out of $55 million has been spent. They've spent 26% of total contracting dollars have gone toward these minority and women-owned businesses. 26 out of 30 is the goal. Proponents asserted that passing the bond would create a total of $440 million leveraged by city investment. And then this is this figure references a larger pool of money, including project costs, for which Forever Home has provided gap financing. For instance, if Forever Home Durham pays for $2 million of a $6.5 million project, all $6.5 million is factored in for this metric. Let's see. Paging. This is an extremely long article, as I mentioned. So you hear a lot of paper shuffling as I keep my act rolling along. Well, in fact, it's a summary of takeaways for spending of that. As of February 28th, Forever Home Durham has spent about $31 million, and about $14 million is allotted for spending by the end of 2023 fiscal year. And that's for that minority and women-owned businesses. And again, IndyWeek.com will get you to this entire article with some of the graphics, making it more comprehensible at a glance. Okay, can't do that for you. And so I apologize for that, but it is an important if you're in the Durham area or anywhere around the Triangle for that matter. And in keeping with my slightly hurried and off-the-cuff editing of these IndyWeek articles, the next one from Carrie's Chatham Estates is worthy of attention. The mobile home park and their families fear displacement, Jasmine Gallup has written. I will edit out some of the human interest specifications for certain interviews with people and cut to the statistical chase in some of this article. Chatham Estates, which is a mobile home park in Cary, is slated for redevelopment. It's a close to 40-acre property, also home to a strip mall, was put up for sale by owner Curtis Westbrook in March. Initially listed for around $50 million, the sale price is now subject to offer, according to commercial real estate broker Lee & Associates. Despite the fact the property is currently occupied by hundreds of families and business owners, it's marked as a, quote, redevelopment site in downtown Cary with, quote, favorable landlord lease structures. In other words, it would be easy for a buyer to evict the current residents and turn the property into an expensive apartment complex or high-end shopping center. Just down the street, a new work-live-play space, Fenton, opened last year, surrounded by restaurants, stores, and a movie theater. Studio apartment in the complex, a studio apartment, rents for at least $1,800 a month. Other apartments in the area have rents ranging from $1,600 to $1,900 per month. That's far beyond the means of these families, who spend $400 per month renting the land their mobile homes occupy. Many spend thousands of dollars just to get here, paying for moving costs, repairs, and utility hookups. Enir Oseguera, who's lived at Chatham for about 5 months, saved for 2 years to pay for his move. At his old Durham apartment, he and other residents from Central America weren't treated well by management, he says. Here it's much better. The rent's cheaper, and there's more space for his kids to play. He's also surrounded by a community that speaks his language, Oseguera says. It was shocking because we were happy to have found a place to live. By staying here, the truth is we are being left without a roof. From here, I don't know where to go. If displaced, the estate residents might be able to move their mobile homes to another park, but that's far from guaranteed. Many of these homes are so old they're likely to fall apart in transit, says Katya Robuck, an organizer with One Wake. If 10 can be moved, that'll be a blessing, she says. While she was knocking on doors, Robuck woke up parents who were asleep because they'd worked the late shift. She met children sorting produce at the kitchen table. They're already poor, she adds. What are they going to do? Where are they going to go? In Cary, recently ranked one of the most desirable places to live in America, the risk of eviction or rent hikes for non-homeowners has become almost an inevitability. As long-time property owners decide to sell, out-of-town developers swoop in to bid on land that's now extremely valuable. Chatham Estates, for example, is now worth a little over $6 million, according to a recent Wake County tax assessment. Of course, a private developer who buys it could choose to keep the Chatham Estates mobile home park as is, but there's a slim chance of that, especially since the land is in a premium location at the intersection of East Chatham and Southeast Maynard Road. Property owner could also sell below market value, perhaps, to a nonprofit or government agency that would preserve existing affordable housing. But again, that holds little appeal when they can easily profit from a competitive real estate market. Cary Town Council member Don France, whose seat is up for re-election this month, says, I've never seen somebody sell their home below market rate to help with affordability crisis. Everybody's going for maximum profit, and I get that. But creating affordable housing is not just a government solution. It's a community problem. Westbrook, the current owner of Chatham, has told news outlets he's only selling due to his health and inability to continue managing the property. In an interview with the News and Observer, he says he loves his tenants and would like to see the mobile home park preserved, but he doesn't seem to have taken any action to make that dream a reality. It would make no sense for me to put conditions on the sale, he told the NNO. My property's gotten old and needs to be revived. Everything changes. This is just a continuation of Cary's growth. He didn't respond to the Indy's publication request for comments. Cary Town Council might also be able to play a role in helping preserve Chatham Estates. Towns and cities across Wake County have preserved affordable housing in the past through partnerships with nonprofits, namely by helping fund the purchase of the properties. France, who represents District B, Chatham Estates' location, says he's open to discussions about preserving the mobile home park, either through sale or by working with current or future owners. But he adds, that's got to be brought to us. The town has no control over private property sales, nor can it dictate what an owner builds on a site, as long as the developer complies with zoning regulations. Chatham Estates is currently zoned for commercial and residential, which means it could easily become home to an apartment complex with accompanying office or retail space up to 12 stories. If a developer wants to build taller buildings on the site or otherwise exceed the zoning rules, that's when the town can step in, says France. Rezoning requests give towns like Cary leverage to request that developers do something for the community, like build affordable housing. France says the developer might have a bigger, bolder version than what's allowed under current entitlements, so if you want us to help you, you have to help us meet our community goals. Providing workforce affordable housing, helping those that may be displaced, relocation assistance, guaranteed space in the new development, whatever that looks like. But the reality is that Cary might not want to help preserve the mobile home park. It doesn't fit in with the up-and-coming image the town wants to portray for potential residents, business, and developers. In a post on his website, Kerry Mayor Harold Weinbrick wrote, "We have a keen eye on the sale and welcome the opportunity to work with any potential new owners to communicate Kerry's vision and needs." But what exactly is Kerry's vision? According to the Community 2040 Community Plan, the property currently home to Chatham Estates would ideally become a, quote, supporting neighborhood with apartments, condos, or townhouses. Meanwhile, the central corridor along East Chatham Street and Chapel Hill Road is already slated to become home to retail or office buildings up to six stories high. With major public transport improvements planned, the town council also hopes to encourage better street connections and add sidewalks. These could all be good things for Kerry residents, but it could also hasten gentrification. Kerry has shown support for affordable housing as the town grows. Recently, the town council approved the development of about 130 units of mixed-income housing, serving people making 50 to 100% of the area median income, at 921 Southeast Maynard Road. This year, the town also dedicated about $10 million in local and federal funds to support various affordable housing programs. France said, "This is something that's been on our radar for quite some time. A lot of duplexes and triplexes downtown are going away, making room for big mansions. So we get it, and we're continuing to invest a lot more heavily in affordable housing initiatives, but it is a challenge. We're trying to do what we can to help, but it takes everyone." Regarding Chatham Estates, Weinbrick says town employees have spoken with local groups interested in helping residents, including Dorcas Ministries, local YMCAs, The Carrying Place, One Wake, and Western Regional Housing Action Group. But ultimately, it comes down to the will of the people in charge. In an effort to advocate for residents, nonprofit One Wake organized several meetings in Chatham, helping bridge the language barrier between the Latino families and town officials. More recently, the nonprofit held a forum with the Kerry Town Council candidates asking if they would support specific affordable housing solutions. After hearing testimony from residents and business owners, each candidate in attendance, that is five of the nine running for office this fall, agreed to support the nonprofit's demands, including compensation for residents and business owners displaced if Chatham Estates is sold. City Council members, namely at-large candidates Lori Bush and Mary Innsbrucker, District B candidates Michelle Craig and Don France, and District D candidate Rachel Jordan, agreed to help cover relocation expenses for mobile homes and business, as well as pay people for any equity lost in homes that cannot be moved. Roebuck, the organizer with One Wake, secured similar compensation for the residents of Wake Forest's Wellington Mobile Park in 2021. But today, she's wondering if Chatham Estates residents can get a better deal. Roebuck says, "Wellington residents got money, so maybe the Chatham Estates can get the same. But then I was thinking, wait a minute, they don't have to get the same. Maybe they can get more. Maybe this time we can do better." Over the past 9 months, Roebuck has talked to these families, met their children, and been invited into their homes. She says the families want to stay. They make these homes for Kerry residents look beautiful because they clean them, do landscaping, construction. They pay taxes. Some of them are voters. They contribute to the prosperity of Kerry, so why can't they stay? She says while her job is to help advocate for the families, she's not paid to love or respect them. But those connections end up happening regardless. And she adds, Kerry has room to build beautiful buildings and new developments to enrich the city and the county. But is Kerry really including everybody in their plans? Is there really inequality in the town of Cary when it comes to housing? That's a rhetorical question, I assume. Now, thanks to my incredible self-editing capabilities already manifested today so far, be sure to write in and compliment me for it, I have a chance to read some older articles that I never got to, and they stayed in my Read Older Articles section of the folder. And this music article is about the group Mipso, and it was written in the 20th of September by Spencer Griffith. In June of 2022, more than a decade after forming Mipso, the North Carolina quartet was touring through Europe to support their adventurous self-titled album, when, according to mandolin player Jacob Sharp, the aforementioned kicking ass began. Lost instruments, missing merchandise, food poisoning, bedbugs, stolen personal belongings were just some of the woes that piled on during that COVID-stricken tour, which led to some frank mid-tour talks. Sharp says, there were some real reckoning chats in the moment of like, does this make sense? Do we do it again? The domestic tour for Mipso had already shown the band the elements of the touring model that were effectively broken as they navigated an industry wreaked by the pandemic, barely breaking even on tours despite high attendance, including sold-out shows, has been particularly disheartening. Bassist Wood Robinson, commenting on that tour, said, my worst moments while on tour have been when everything else has made it so I can't be purely in the moment playing music with my friends. Spurred by those conversations, Mipso took a fresh approach to their sixth album, Book of Fools, which, by the way, was released on 1 RPM, released August the 25th. Let's see. The band took full advantage of a nearly three-year gap since the release of their previous album, the longest gap thus far, between Mipso Records, and finally allowed themselves time to stretch out both development of new material and the recording process. Sharp says of the album approach, before we knew what the songs would be and where we'd go sonically, we knew we wanted to change the process to be slower and have more time. Specifically, more time away from the road that was involved with writing and recording. Over a year and a half, the band's deliberate process, including a writing retreat in the North Carolina mountains, workshopping songs in Wisconsin, and for the first time, tracking directly to tape with producer Shane Leonard in California. Fiddler Libby Rodenbaugh recalls the band had always lamented a lack of time to experiment on previous records, although, she says, once they started, they could have continued tinkering with Book of Fools 10 tracks for weeks longer. She says, I think that wasting time by the standards of our world is probably for some of the best artists made. It's a real shame to think how much isn't getting made because of those parameters of time and money. Many of the songs on Book of Fools went through dramatically different iterations before reaching the final form. Sharp says, I'm less surprised by which songs made the album and more by which version of the song made the album, offering up as an example the moody and atmospheric Break It to You Anyhow, which evolved from stripped down beginnings. The lead single, Carolina Rolling By, wouldn't sound too out of place on the quartet's earlier records, though Lap Steel has a decidedly cosmic touch. Despite the track evoking shades of previous material, Mipso's members struggle to define their sound as it has changed over the years. As Robinson sees it, they share no preconceived notion about how Mipso should sound. The synthesizer-laden radio hell, which thumbs its nose at the exploitative nature of the music industry, stands in sharp contrast to what longtime listeners may have come to expect from the band. Guitarist Joseph Terrell, who swaps his acoustic for an electric far more often than on previous albums, has said, I think there's less of a Mipso sound and more a process. What we found is that we like making records together, and the more we've done it, the better we figured out the best version of combining these four voices. That might be a different formula and a different sound every time if we're changing and growing as people. And Sharp adds, part of our story is that we were already this happy accident. We didn't have a band that we conceptualized as fully formed. We just wanted to play music and wanted to do it with each other. He was speaking of the group's origin at UNC Chapel Hill, where the four met as students. This intentionality, choosing to make music together as they've gone separate ways after college, is a defining aspect of the band's music. That doesn't mean they plan to leave that past behind either. As they battle around a return to acoustic string band instrumentation on a future album. And this past summer, they also recorded two songs at Amelia Meath and Nick Sanborn's studio, Betty's, in Chapel Hill. With Sharp releasing his first solo single called Other Side, a gentle piece of folk pop featuring harmonies from Eofy O'Donnell and Terrell, his debut album this year, all four of the band now have their own personal musical endeavors. Rodenbaugh's second solo record, Between the Blades, was released in May, while Robinson leads experimental outfit The Other Band and the jazzy New Formal. As Mipso operates in a democratic fashion, those outlets provide a home for songs that don't end up resonating with the entire group. After being recorded and later cut for Coming Down the Mountain, the song Colored was transformed into a bright pop ditty on Rodenbaugh's solo debut years later. These solo explorations, too, mean that each member has broader horizons when collaborating. At the suggestion of Leonard, the band revisited East, a song Rodenbaugh originally wrote for the podcast Song Confessional for the album. Terrell says, at the risk of sounding overly earnest, this record-making process was kind of revelatory. We just let ourselves do stuff we've never done before. Playing some of the biggest shows of their career on this tour, including favorite rooms they've never before headlined, like Chicago's Thalia Hall and San Francisco's Great American Music Hall, the band seems reinvigorated with the new album in tow. They've also added pre-show acoustic performances to their routine, both in an effort to address the economic realities of touring in 23 and in hopes of forging deeper personal connections with fans. Rodenbaugh also says that the live tracking done while recording Book of Fools, that means that translating those songs to the stage will be more fun and exciting for them as it keeps them on their toes. And Robinson closes this article, says, the new batch necessitates that we are very focused on exactly what's happening at the time, which makes it a lot easier for everything else that's going on to not end up clouding the moment. All of the kvetching we do about the reality of touring and the fact that capitalism is sucking the ability to live when this is your livelihood, all of that just evaporates for me on the downbeat. So again, this article, Mipso, and their release titled Book of Fools, released on August 25th on 1 RPM. And my last excerpted article, since I'm running out of time, is about a sushi bar located inside a gas station in Apex. And this is a long-held-over article from July. Every day for 2 years, Bird Owatrigul drove past the same gas station in Apex on his way to work, and every day for 2 years, he thought the same thing. There, inside that handy Hugo's, that's where I'll open my first restaurant. Specifically, Owatrigul had his eye on this gas station's in-store subway space, which he felt had the bones of a sushi bar. The space, tucked at the end of the hallway just past Handy Hugo's restrooms, was intimate, as sushi bars traditionally are. It didn't have a kitchen, but Owatrigul didn't need one. The sandwich counter, already outfitted with refrigeration, would do the trick. And while the parking lot outside Subway's street entrance was always empty, Ouachougou viewed that as a good sign. It meant the location was on its last legs, he thought. Not that attracting customers would be a problem. Sure enough, in December of 2019, the subway sputtered to a halt, and a year and a half later, Ouachougou saw his vision through. Since then, Akami Sushi Bar has emerged as a profound metamorphism of its sandwich chain predecessor. The counter that once harbored tuna salad with the controversial composition, its purveyor created a tuna facts website to clarify any misunderstandings, now boasts a sleek case stocked with freshly caught bluefin, yellowfin, and dozen other fishes. The linoleum floors have been replaced with hardwood, the faux brick walls painted pebble gray and adorned with Japanese artwork. The seating, previously made up of hard laminate stools that compelled patrons to perch, not sit, is now comfortable enough that customers who land a coveted spot at one of the monthly omakase dinners can enjoy the hours-long meal without growing tired. What hasn't changed since Subway days is the presence of a somewhat satiric tagline. Akami's is the gas station sushi. Subway's, of course, was eat fresh. The price of a solid lunch, which runs between $10 and $15, dinner is in the $20 to $30 range, and a chunk of the clientele who happily shifted from footlongs to nigiri and sashimi mori. Now, though, regulars hang around a bit longer. They get to know each other. They get to know their chef, who stores personal chopsticks for them on a shelf behind the counter. Ouachougou borrowed the chopstick idea from one of his many mentors. After moving from Thailand to the United States at 21 and attending college in Virginia, Ouachougou relocated to South Florida and set off on what would become a years-long journey to mastering sushi, an art form he admired for its simplicity. From the beginning, he showed the potential to one day launch his own concept. He knows this, he says, because 2 years into his first stint as sushi chef at restaurant company Benihana, he was told that he was not worth it to teach. Ouachougou says, when sushi chefs are training you, they're looking for a certain mentality so that when you grow with the company. He was too independent for Benihana's liking. He convinced his boss to give him another chance, but in a move that perhaps cemented his role as maverick, promptly quit the next day. The pay was too low, he said. He spent another 2 years at an independent sushi bar across the street and jumped around for three more. Anywhere I could learn, I stayed. If I had nothing to learn, I quit. And now, speaking of quitting, I'm afraid I have to quit with this article long from... Not finished, but the location of Akami Sushi Bar, 1561 East William Street in Apex. And they are phone 919-267-6368. John Federson saying so long then for ncreadingservice.org, with Indie Week. So long, and be with you next week. Enjoy your lunch.